You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner in English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 183 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Human Evolution, A Spiritual Scientific Quest, 9 Lectures, translated by Simon Blaxland DeLange. This is Lecture 6, given in Dornach on the 26th of August, 1918. Certain questions increasingly thrust themselves on the attention of thinking people, even though in these times, when a materialistic culture predominates, they would, on the whole, prefer to ignore them. There are many such questions. Today I should like to select a few from the considerable number of questions that arise by virtue of the fact that despite the resistance that people have to becoming aware of a spiritual world, they nevertheless sense its presence. Among such questions are these, for example, which are brought up in the course of everyday life. Some people die young. Others die when they are really old. Others somewhere in between. With regard to this fact, that on the one hand, young children die, and on the other hand, people become quite old before they die, questions arise in people's minds, which, as everyone would need to admit, if they really thought about it, cannot be answered with what are today called scientific means. Nevertheless, these are urgent questions for human life. And surely anyone can sense that an immense number of things in life would be clarified if one could address questions such as why some human beings die early, whether as children, as adolescents, or in the prime of life, and why others die when they are old. What significance does this have for the world as a whole? People still had ideas and concepts for answering such questions until that point of time to which I have already drawn your attention in these lectures. That is, the beginning of the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, roughly the middle of the 8th century B.C. These concepts were a legacy of ancient wisdom. In those ancient times that preceded the 8th pre-Christian century, ideas that gave people answers to questions such as those indicated in a way that they could understand were circulating throughout the earthly cultures of that time. What we call science today has no way of approaching such questions and does not even consider that there is any reason why one should look for an answer to them. This is due to the fact that in the period that has elapsed since the point of time indicated, all ideas relating to the spiritual or immortal aspect of man's being have actually been lost. The only ideas that remain are those that have a bearing on man's transient nature, that part of human nature that is encompassed between birth and death. I have pointed out that in all ancient conceptions of the world, people spoke of a threefold sun, referring, as they did, to that same sun that one perceives as a radiant sphere out in space. However, behind this sun, the sages of olden times saw the soul aspect of the sun, which the Greeks called Helios, and behind this again, the spiritual sun, which Plato, for example, identified with the good. People today do not see any real sense in speaking of Helios, the soul aspect of the sun, or, for that matter, of the spiritual sun, of the good. But just as the physical sun shines upon us here, between birth and death, so, I must emphasize, does the spiritual sun, which Plato identifies with the good, shed its light upon our ego in the time that we spend between death and a new birth. It makes no sense to speak of this radiant sphere, associated with our modern materialistic worldview, in relation to the time between death and a new birth. During this time, it only makes sense to speak of the spiritual sun, referred to by Plato as the good. But it is precisely this kind of concept which is able to point us in the right direction. It can enable us to subject our physical conception of the world to critical examination. No serious consideration would, after all, be given to the notion, or at any rate not to the point where our outlook on life were to be influenced by it, that the physical representations that we form of the world, what is spread out before our senses, are a kind of illusion, a sort of maya. Thus, anyone who regards modern physics, or astrophysics if you prefer, as authoritative, conceives of the sun in the following way. If he were able to go to where physicists place the sun, he would, on approaching the sun — we may for present purposes ignore the circumstances of human life and consider the conditions from an absolute point of view — become aware of an immense heat. This is how he would imagine it. And, on arriving within the space that physicists conceive as being filled by the sun, he would find in this place something of the nature of fiery gas. This is how a physicist would think of it, a fiery ball of gas, or something of the kind. But it is not like that. Such an idea is maya, a complete illusion. It does not even stand up to the scrutiny of such physical perception as can be achieved, never mind any real supersensible perception. If one were really able to get close to the sun and enter the space where the sun is, one would, on approaching it, find something that has a similar effect to going through floods of light. A drawing was made of a yellow circle with a blue center. But if one were fully to enter the place where physicists imagine the physical sun to be, one would initially find what one might identify as empty space. There is nothing there at all. There is absolutely nothing where the physical sun is supposed to be. I shall draw it diagrammatically, blue, because nothing is actually there at all. Nothing is there, only empty space. But what a strange empty space it is. When I say that nothing is there, I am not speaking altogether accurately, for there is less than nothing there. It is not merely an empty space, but it contains less than nothing. An idea of this nature is extraordinarily difficult for modern Westerners to picture. Someone from the East would even today accept such an idea as a matter of course. For him, there is nothing miraculous or difficult to understand if one were to say to him that less than nothing is there. The Westerner thinks to himself, especially if he is a devoted follower of Kant — and far more people are Kantians, unconscious Kantians, than one might suppose — that if nothing is in a space, it must therefore be an empty space. But this is not the case. A space can also be emptied out. If you were to look through the sun's corona, you would find the empty space that you would then enter most uncomfortable, for it would tear you apart. In this way, it manifests its actual nature, that it is more, or, as I would rather say, less than an empty space. You need only to avail yourselves of the simplest mathematical concepts in order to cease finding what I am trying to say so puzzling, that an empty space is less than merely being empty. Let us suppose that you possess a property of some kind. It may also happen that you have given away what you possess and have nothing. But one can also have less than nothing. One can have debts. And then one truly has less than nothing. One can go from a space that is totally full to one that is ever less so, until one ends up with an empty space. And one can then go beyond mere emptiness in the same way that one can go from nothing to having debts. That is the great misconception of the modern worldview, that it does not recognize this distinctive kind of negative materiality, if I may use such an expression, that it recognizes only emptiness and fullness and not what is less than emptiness. It is because knowledge in our time, the modern worldview, has no understanding of what is less than emptiness, that this same modern worldview is to all intents and purposes shackled to materialism. Well and truly shackled to materialism, or I might even say under its spell. For there is also a place within man, I may say, which is emptier than empty, not in its totality, but which has parts that are emptier than empty. Man, I am referring now to the physical human being, is, as a whole, a being who materially fills a space, but a certain member of human nature, of the three to which I have referred, does indeed have something about it which is like the sun, emptier than empty. This is, and I am afraid you'll just have to accept it, the head. It is just because man is organized in such a way that his head can become empty, and in certain parts of it can be emptier than empty, that the head has the possibility of making room for the spiritual dimension of life. Just picture the reality of this situation. Of course, this has to be done diagrammatically, but you may imagine that everything materially filling your head is indicated diagrammatically by what I am about to draw. This would be your head, see diagram red. But if I'm going to draw it properly, I shall have to leave some empty spaces in this head. These are, of course, not so big, but there are empty spaces inside it. And into these empty spaces, what I have over the course of these days referred to as the youthful spirit can enter. This youthful spirit, in the form of its rays, is then incorporated in the drawing, yellow. Now, the materialists say that the brain is the instrument of the soul life, of the thinking. The opposite is true. The holes in the brain, what are more than holes, parenthesis, or I could also say less than holes, close parenthesis, are the instrument of the soul life. And where there is no soul life, where the soul life is continually impinging, where the space in our skull is filled with the substance of the brain, nothing is thought. Nothing is experienced by the soul. We need our physical brain not for our life of soul. We need it merely in order that we can take hold of our soul life, physically take hold of it. If the soul life that actually lives in the holes of the brain were not everywhere pushing against what is around it, it would vanish. It would never reach our consciousness. But it lives in the holes of the brain, which are emptier than empty. So we must gradually correct our concepts. When we are standing in front of a mirror, we do not perceive ourselves, but only our reflected image. We can forget ourselves. We see ourselves in the mirror. In the same way, a person does not experience himself by assembling with his brain what lies in the holes of the brain. He experiences the way in which his soul life is reflected whenever it comes up against the substance of the brain. This reflective process takes place everywhere. And this is what a person experiences. He is actually experiencing the reflected image of his soul life. whereas what slips through into the holes is that which then, once a person has passed through the gate of death, becomes conscious of itself without the resistance of the brain, because in that situation it is imbued with consciousness in a completely opposite sense. I shall now draw another diagram, which I can portray as follows. Forgive me if I now draw the brain somewhat drastically, so that I allow for the holes, blue. Here is the substance of the brain, allowing space for the holes, and into these holes goes the life of the soul, yellow. The soul life, however, continues apart from the holes. In this way we come to the human aura, which is naturally only visible in close proximity to a person, but extends to an indeterminate degree. Let us now think away the brain, and imagine that we are observing the soul life of an ordinary person between birth and death. We would have to say that, seen in this way, the person, as he actually is, between birth and death, is such that, and it is clear that I shall have to draw this in a different way diagrammatically, his face is turned like this toward his body. See diagram 3, lilac. His soul life is inclined toward his bodily existence. And when we look at the brain, this soul life stretches out feelers which enter the holes of the brain. What I formerly, see diagram 2, depicted in yellow, I am now drawing in lilac, because this is more appropriate for a perception of a living person. It would be this that extends into the brain of a living human being. If I were now to draw a physical person, I would best be able to indicate this by showing the boundary to which the faculty of memory extends. It would reach outward at this point. And this would be the outer boundary, the boundary of cognition, of which I have also spoken to you. You will need here to recall the previous diagrams and the third diagram that I drew yesterday. But now it is indeed the case that if one contemplates man spiritually from without, his soul life extends into him thus. I shall, therefore, draw the single extending line only with respect to the brain. But this soul life is also differentiated. So, if I were to continue my investigation of the life of the soul, I would need to draw another region here, red under the lilac, and another one here, blue. Thus, all this would form part of what constitutes the human aura. Then another region, green. You see that this part that I am now drawing lies beyond the limits of human cognition. Then this region, yellow, and this region, orange, all actually belong to the human individual. When a person is asleep, this moves more or less out of the body, as was drawn yesterday, diagram 2, and when he is awake, it is more or less within the body, so that the aura can be perceived in a soul sense only in the immediate vicinity of the body. In describing man's physical organism, one would say that the physical human being consists of lungs, heart, liver, gallbladder, and so on. This is what the anatomist or the physiologist would say. One can, in a very similar way, describe the soul and spiritual aspect of man's being, which extends in this way into the holes within man, into what is more than empty within him. You can describe this equally well. But you must then state what this soul spiritual aspect of man's being consists of. For just as organs can be distinguished in man's physical organism, so here one can one distinguish particular streams. One can say that where I have drawn the red, the physical human being would be standing thus in profile. The face would be turned in this direction. The eyes would be here, see diagram 3. And here would be the region of burning desires, red. This would be one element of man's soul spiritual being, which has derived its substance from the region which you know from the title Theosophy as that of burning desires. Thus a certain aspect of burning desires that has been incorporated into man gives rise to this part of him. If I am going into detail, I would have to characterize what I have drawn here in lilac as the soul life. As you know, a certain part of the soul realm, the soul land, is referred to as the soul life. Its substance would be this violet or lilac area, which forms part of man's soul spiritual being. What I have drawn in orange would, if we continue naming them all, be called the active soul force. So you would have to imagine that what enters into you by way of your senses in the course of the life between birth and death is your soul life. And behind is the active soul force holding itself back, not thrusting forward and held up by the soul life. Still further behind is what we can call the soul light, and forcing its way through would be that which is derived from the region of attraction and repulsion. I would have to associate this with the green area, see diagram. Then the realm of wishes would have a bluish tinge, and then, thrusting itself up against the blue, but tending more toward a bluish red, would be the region of flowing susceptibility. What I refer to here as burning desire, flowing susceptibility, and wishes are auric streams. As you know, these auric streams constitute the soul world, but they also make up man's soul spiritual being, which is composed of the elements of this soul world. At death, the physical body falls away, and the individual human being withdraws what has extended itself into the physical body by way of the holes. He takes it away. And by doing so, and in this context we can remove the physical being of man from our considerations, he enters into a certain relationship with the soul world, and then also with the spirit land, as you find described in title Theosophy. He has this relationship through having these elements within him. During physical life, however, they are bound up with the physical body, and then they become free. Through their becoming free, everything is gradually transformed. During physical life, the feelers, see the left, dark-shaded part of diagram 4, I have now removed the differentiations and am drawing the soul life in this simplified way, are extended into our holes. After death, they are withdrawn. But through the feelers being withdrawn, the soul life itself is hollowed out, and the life of the spirit emerges within the soul life. The spiritual life is absorbed from the other side, light-shaded area. To the same extent that a person ceases to be immersed in the physical body, the soul spiritual aspect of his being lights up, filling his aura with light from the other side. And just as he is able to attain consciousness as a result of the reflection caused by the continual impact of his soul spiritual being upon his physical body, so does he now acquire a consciousness by drawing back against the light. But this is that first light of the sun, which is associated with the good. So whereas, during his physical life, man as a soul spiritual being pushes against what is related to the sun, namely against the more than empty holes in the brain, when he withdraws after death, he encounters the other sun, the good sun, the first sun. You see how the possibility of acquiring concepts of the life between death and a new birth is bound up with the fundamental ideas of the ancient mysteries. For we are to such a degree placed within the whole of the cosmic life that I have been speaking to you about in the course of these days. But in order to arrive at true concepts of these matters, one needs to enter more deeply into the whole structure of human evolution during the earthly age. It could, after all, be possible that through a particular stroke of good fortune, as one might call it, someone would have a clairvoyant perception of the whole of what I have been describing. But the stroke of good fortune could not lead beyond seeing ever-changing images. One could put it roughly like this. Let us suppose that through some kind of miracle, although these things do not happen miraculously, thus through some sort of clairvoyant, supersensible experience, someone were to see man's life of soul and spirit in a similar way to how I have been trying to portray it here. You will find that it makes sense that this should look rather different from what I was describing a short time ago as the normal aura, if you understand that a few days ago, see Lecture 2, Diagram 2, I was describing the aura that results when one sees the whole person, thus the physical human being and the aura that surrounds him. Whereas, I have now taken out the soul and spiritual aspect of man's being, so that this aspect is abstracted from the physical aspect. From this you can see that one sometimes needs to arrange the colors one way and sometimes in another way. And you can also see that for a supersensible consciousness, things look very different. Set yourself the task of simply seeing the human aura as it is while a person is in the physical body. Then look at this aura. Turn your attention, therefore, from man as a soul spiritual being, and try to see someone who merely extends his organs into the physical aspect of man. But when you see a person, in the time between death and a new birth, you again see how everything is transformed. In particular, this region that I have drawn red here, diagram 3, goes away from where it is and goes up here. The yellow goes down here, and the whole picture gradually becomes confused. One can perceive such things, but it becomes confusing to look at them. This is why it will not be easy for people today to find a way of bringing sense and meaning to this confusion, unless they resort to other means of assistance. We have indicated that the human head points toward the past, while the extremities point toward the future. It is a total contrast, a polar opposite situation. Whereas, if you recall what I said yesterday, the head and the extremities are actually one and the same. The head is a very old formation. It is overformed. That is why it has the holes. There are no holes in the extremities, which are not as yet completely filled with matter. To have these holes is a sign of overdevelopment. A backward-looking development can be seen in the head, and much depends on that. Much also depends on understanding that the extremities are a youthful metamorphosis, whereas the head is an old metamorphosis. And because the extremities represent a youthful metamorphosis, they are unable, as yet, to think here in physical life, but are deeply unconscious. They do not open up such holes to the soul spiritual aspect of man's being, as does the brain. This is of infinite importance, and will, in future, become more and more important for intellectual and cultural life. To understand that two things which are in an outward physical sense as completely different from one another as are the head and the extremities are, in a soul spiritual sense, one and the same, although at different stages of development in time. Many mysteries lie in this fact that two physically diverse things can actually be one and the same thing at temporally different stages of development. From an outward physical point of view, they are quite different. but they are developmental states or metamorphoses of the same thing. Goethe's theory of metamorphosis represents an initial attempt to clothe something of this nature with concepts. Whereas the development of appropriate concepts had come to a standstill since ancient times, this faculty reemerged with Goethe. These concepts are the living concepts of metamorphosis. Goethe began with the simplest things. He said that if we look at a plant, we see its green leaves, but they are transformed into the colored petals of the flower. Both are the same. They are merely metamorphoses of one another. Just as the green leaf of the plant and the red rose petal are metamorphoses of one another, the same thing at different stages, man's head and his extremities too are simply metamorphoses of each other. If we consider Goethe's idea of the metamorphosis of the plant, we have something primitive, simple, but this idea can bring to fruition one of great sublimity, in that it can serve to describe the transition that a human being makes from one incarnation to another. We see a plant with its green leaves and its blossom and say, the blossom, the red rose blossom, has arisen from the green leaf. We see a human being standing before us and say, the head that you bear represents your transformed arms, hands, legs, and feet from your previous incarnation. And the arms, hands, legs, and feet that you have now will be transformed into your head for your next incarnation. But now there comes an objection which clearly weighs heavily upon you. You will say, but surely I am going to leave my legs and feet behind, and my arms and hands as well. I'm certainly not taking them with me into my next incarnation. How will my head develop out of them? This objection is perfectly understandable. But you would again be clinging to Maya. It is, you see, not true that you actually leave your legs and your feet, your hands and your arms behind. This is not really so. You say this because you are clinging to Maya, to the great illusion. What you ordinarily call your arms and hands, your legs and feet, are not your arms and hands and your legs and feet, but rather the blood and other fluids that are filling your arms and hands and your legs and feet. This is a difficult idea to take hold of, but it is true. We do indeed have arms and hands, legs and feet, but what we have here is of a spiritual nature. They are spiritual forces. You need to realize that your arms and hands, your legs and feet are forces, supersensible forces. If you only had these forces, you would not see them with your eyes. They have been filled out. These forces have been filled out with fluids, with blood, and what you see as mineral substance, which is largely fluid in nature, and only to the smallest degree solid, fills out these invisible forces. And Reader's Aside, a hatching in Diagram 5, end of Reader's Aside. What you leave in the grave, or what is burnt, are merely what might be called the mineral inclusions. Your arms and hands, your legs and feet are not visible feet, and so forth. They are forces, and you take them with you. You take the forms with you. You say, I have hands and feet. Someone who perceives the spiritual worlds does not say, I have hands and feet. Rather, does he say that there are spirits of form, Elohim, who have cosmic thoughts, and their thoughts are my arms and hands and legs and feet, and their thoughts are filled out with blood and other fluids. But again, blood and other fluids are, likewise, not what they appear to be physically. These substances are the ideas of the spirits of wisdom. And what the physicist calls matter is merely the outer semblance. When the physicist conceives of matter, he should say, here I am encountering a thought of the spirits of form, the curiosities. And when you see arms and hands, legs and feet, which you cannot really even touch, you should say, here, the cosmic thoughts of the spirits of form are shaping my bodily forms. In short, however strange it may seem, there are no such things as your bodies. But where your body is in space, the cosmic thoughts of the higher hierarchies are intermingled. And if you were to see rightly instead of in accordance with Maya, you would say that the cosmic thoughts of the exousiai, the spirits of form, the Elohim, are projecting into it. These cosmic thoughts make themselves visible to me through being filled out with the cosmic thoughts of the spirits of wisdom. That gives us arms and hands, legs and feet. Nothing whatsoever can be beheld by spiritual vision in the way that it appears in Maya. There are only cosmic thoughts. And these cosmic thoughts gather together and are condensed, are thrust against one another, with the result that they appear to us as these shadowy figures, in whose form we walk around, believing that they are real. Thus physical man does not exist at all. We can say with a certain qualification that in the hour of death the spirits of form separate their cosmic thoughts from the cosmic thoughts of the spirits of wisdom. The spirits of form take their thoughts up into the air. The spirits of wisdom lower their material thoughts into the earth. Because of this, there is in the corpse a shadowy legacy of the thoughts of the spirits of wisdom when the spirits of form have taken their thoughts back into the air. This is physical death. This is what it really is. In short, when we begin to think about reality, we arrive at the dissolution of what we ordinarily call the physical world. For this physical world derives its existence from an active interweaving of the thoughts of the spirits of the higher hierarchies with one another. I would, therefore, ask you to imagine that finely distributed particles of water are being interspersed, forming a thick mist. That is also why your body has such a shadowy aspect, because the thoughts of the spirits of form are penetrating those of the spirits of wisdom. The formative thoughts are pervading the thoughts of substance. When viewed in this way, the whole world dissolves into a spiritual perspective. But it is important to be able to conceive of the world in a truly spiritual way, to know that it is only apparent that my arms and hands, my feet and legs are given over to the earth. The truth of the matter is that the metamorphosis of my arms and hands, legs and feet, is beginning there and will be completed in the life between death and a new birth. And my arms and legs, hands and feet, will become my head in my next incarnation. Much of what I have been saying now may, at any rate, in the way that it has been expressed, have struck you as somewhat strange. But what have we ultimately been saying, if it is not that we are ascending from a semblance of man to true man, from what lives outwardly in Maya to the successive ranks of the hierarchies? Only if one does this can one speak in a mature way today of man's potential to acquire knowledge of a so-called higher self. If one merely makes declarations about the higher self, if one simply says, "I feel a higher self within me," it has no substance, for the ordinary self belongs to Maya and is therefore itself Maya. The higher self has meaning only if one speaks of it in relation to the world of the higher hierarchies. To speak of the higher self without taking account of the world that consists of the spirits of form and the angels, archangels, and so forth, to speak of the higher self without reference to this world signifies that one is speaking in empty abstractions, and it also means that one is not speaking of what lives in man between death and a new birth. For just as we live here with animals, plants, and minerals, so do we live between death and a new birth with the kingdoms of the higher hierarchies, of whom we have often spoken. Only when we gradually come nearer to these ideas and concepts, which will not be possible for another week or so, will we be able to approach an answer to the question, why do many people die as young children, many in old age, and others somewhere in between? What I have now described to you in outline are concrete concepts for the realities of the world. They are indeed not abstract concepts that I have been presenting to you. They are concrete concepts of world realities. Such concepts are as these existed in the ancient mysteries, albeit for a more atavistic perception. Since the 8th century BC, they have been lost to human perception, and they must be rediscovered through a deepening of our comprehension of the Christ being. This can only happen on a path of inner spiritual scientific research. Let us once more form for ourselves a kind of overview of human evolution from a particular standpoint. The concepts that we are now wanting to grasp are extremely important. It can be said that if one looks back over human evolution, one comes to see, as I have often described, that in olden times people had more of the group soul nature, and that individual souls were initially members of such a group soul. You can read about this in various cycles. One could accordingly portray human evolution diagrammatically by saying that in former times there were group souls, and each of these group souls split up. This is how it would appear to a purely soul-based perception. For a spiritual perception, it would be somewhat different. Each of these souls is then clothed with a body, which I am indicating here with red lines, see diagram 6. Until the time of the Pythagorean school, people would make drawings of this sort, and they would say, "Look at your bodies. Human beings are separated as regards their bodies. Each one has his own body. That is why the red lines are isolated from one another." But as far as souls are concerned, mankind is a unity. In that we go back in the dim, distant past to the group soul. There we have a unity. If you think away the red, the lightly shaded part of the drawing forms a unified figure. However, it only makes sense to speak about this figure if one has first spoken about the spiritual aspect of man's being, as we have today. For then, we know everything that is exerting an influence on these souls, how the higher hierarchies are actively working within them. There is no sense in speaking about this figure if one does not have the hierarchies clearly in mind. People spoke in this way right up to the time of the Pythagorean school, and it was from the Pythagorean school that Apollonius learned what I spoke about yesterday, and about which I shall be speaking further next week. But since the 8th century BC and the Pythagorean schools were a kind of last bastion in this respect, the possibility of speaking in this way has been lost, and the concepts which, through being related to the higher hierarchies, have an intrinsic reality, have become vague and confused for people. Thus, instead of the world of the angels, archangels, archai, spirits of form, spirits of movement, spirits of wisdom and thrones, instead of all this clearly defined weaving of the spirit, they arrived at a concept which came to play a certain part in the perception of the Greeks, that of pneuma, in which everything is intermingled, pneuma, spirit in general. This vague concept which pantheists still love today. Spirit, 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 spirit. I have often spoken of how pantheists place spirit everywhere, but this goes back to the Greeks. This figure is again being portrayed, but you can now see that what was formerly an intrinsic reality, the fullness of the Godhead, has become an abstract concept, pneuma. The white or light-shaded areas are pneuma, The rest is physical matter, see Diagram 6, if one is considering the evolution of mankind. But the Greeks still at least perceived this pneuma, for they saw something of the aura, so that what they pictured in the white or light-shaded branches had an auric quality, and was therefore actually perceptible. This is the great significance of the transition from Greece to Rome, that the Greeks still perceived pneuma as something truly spiritual, but that the Romans did so no longer. With the Romans, everything became completely abstract, a total abstraction, mere concepts. The Romans are the people of abstract concepts. My dear friends, in modern times you find the same diagram in science. You can encounter it today in materialistic books on science. There you find exactly the same diagram that you would have found in the old mysteries, in the Pythagorean schools, where everything was still related to the hierarchies. You find it in the Greeks, where it was related to pneuma. You find people drawing it again today. We shall see what it has become today. Today the scientist says to his students as he draws this same drawing on the blackboard, "In the reproductive process of the human race, the germinal substance of the parents is passed on to the children, but part of this substance remains, so that in the next generation it can again be passed on to the children, and likewise a part of this remains, so that it can once again be passed on to the children, while another part of the germinal substance forms the cells of the physical body." You have exactly the same diagram, except that the modern scientist sees in the white or light-shaded area of Diagram 6 the continuity of the germinal substance. He says, if we go back to our human ancestors and identify their germinal substance, the germinal substance of both male and female, and then go to people today and do the same with them, it is a single stream. The substance is continuous. Something eternal always remains in the germinal substance, so the scientist imagines. And only something like half of the germinal plasma is passed on to the new body. The scientist again has the same figure, but now he no longer has the pneuma. And the white or light-shaded area is the material germinal substance. There is no longer anything of a soul and spiritual nature. It is just material substance. You can read this in what modern scientists write, and it is considered today to be a discovery of great significance. This is the materializing of a lofty spiritual idea, in that it has undergone a process of abstraction. It has an abstract concept at its center. It is amusing to think that a modern scientist has written a book, at least it is amusing to anyone who can think properly, in which he clearly says, what the Greeks still conceived of as pneuma is today's germinal substance with its continuity of existence. Yes, it is a foolish thing to say, but it is considered to be great wisdom today. One thing is, however, clear from this. It is not the drawing that matters. You will therefore understand why I was never very keen on drawing diagrams while we were still trying to implement anthroposophy through the Theosophical Society. One only had to enter any theosophical branch, and one would find the walls plastered with all manner of such diagrams. There were drawings of every conceivable thing, together with descriptive texts. There were whole genealogical trees and sketches of everything imaginable. But what matters is not these drawings. What really counts is that one can really arrive at a living imagination. For the drawing can be exactly the same whether you conceive of it in a soul-spiritual way, as the manifestation of the hierarchies, or whether you are thinking of something purely material, the continuing existence of germinal plasma. People today are very hazy about such things. This is why it is so important to be clear that the Greeks still knew something about man's real self, about spiritual reality, and that the Romans made the transition to abstract concepts. You can see this in purely outward details. When the Greeks speak about their gods, they speak in such a way that one sees very precisely that they are imagining quite specific figures behind these deities. For the Romans, the gods are actually only names, only labels. They are abstractions and become ever more so. For the Greeks, there was still a certain notion that in the person standing before one, the hierarchies are living, and that the hierarchies live differently in each individual. The Greeks related to others in accordance with their reality, and when they said, quote, "This is Alcibiades, this is Socrates, this is Plato," close quote, they still had the concept that in Alcibiades, in Socrates, in Plato, the cosmic thoughts of the hierarchies are being manifested in a variety of ways, and that it is because of this that such different figures appear. This was lost with the Romans. They therefore formed a system of concepts which had its most extreme expression in that from Augustus onward, and actually from somewhat earlier, the Roman Caesar was considered to be God. The Godhead gradually became an abstraction. The Roman Caesar was himself a god, because this concept of God had become completely abstract. But their other concepts also became abstract. This was especially the case with the legal and moral concepts that pervaded the Roman nature, with the result that a whole mountain of abstractions came to replace the ancient heritage of living thoughts. And all these abstractions remained as a legacy throughout the Middle Ages and were bequeathed to modern times, bringing this legacy down to the 19th century. Abstract concepts that are carried into every sphere. In the 19th century, something rather startling happened. Man completely disappeared amongst these abstract concepts. The Greeks still had an inkling of man's true being, which is fashioned from out of the cosmos. In the course of the Roman era, man's being became obscured. It was necessary for the 19th century to rediscover him amidst all the circumstances to which I have already referred, and regarding which I shall speak in greater detail. This discovery of man now emerged from a different pole. The Greeks had sought to view man as the divine human being who originates from the hierarchies. The Romans had replaced this with a series of abstract concepts. The task of the 19th century, and also to some extent the 18th century, but particularly the 19th, was to rediscover man from a different aspect, from the animal side of his nature. However, he could not be understood in this way, with these abstract concepts. This was the great shock, and that is the great shock, the deep cleft that arises. What is this that stands before us on two legs and fidgets with its hands and ears and drinks all kinds of things? What is it? The Greeks still knew the answer, but then this answer was changed into abstract concepts. Now it startles people in the 19th century. There it is, but people have no concepts to grasp it with. They conceive of it as merely a higher animal. On the one hand, from the scientific aspect, there is Darwinism, and on the other hand, from the aspect of the world of ideas, socialism, which would endeavor to view man's place in society as that of an animal. So we have man confronting himself in a state of bewilderment. What is this, I see? And he is powerless to answer this question. That is the situation today. This is the situation which will not only give rise to concepts that are true or false, as people find appropriate, but also brings with it the challenge to accomplish deeds that will be either catastrophic or beneficial in their outcome. This, then, is the situation. The shock that a person has on confronting himself. It has once again become essential to find the elements necessary for the understanding of man as a spiritual being. These elements will not be found unless one turns to the theory of metamorphosis. That is the essential point. Only Goethe's concepts of metamorphosis are able to comprehend the ever-changing phenomena which present themselves to a perception of reality. It would be true to say that the cultural evolution of humanity has always been proceeding in this direction. Even at the time when The Chemical Wedding, titled The Chemical Wedding, and other writings were being published in so wonderful a way in the 17th century, parenthesis, as I have indicated in title Das Reich, in a series of articles entitled The Chemical Wedding of Christian Rosenkreuz, close parenthesis, there was already the endeavor to ensure that a social structure compatible with man's true nature should come into being. It was in this way that titled The Chemical Wedding of Christian Rosenkreuz by the so-called Valentin Andrea came to be written. But on the other hand, there also emerged the book which he called titled Allgemeine Reformation der ganzen weiten Welt, General Reformation of the Whole Wide World, where he gives an extensive political survey of how social conditions might come to be. But all this was swept away by the Thirty Years' War. At that time, it was the Thirty Years' War that swept it all away. Today, it is possible either for the world situation to sweep all this away again, or to adopt it as part of human evolution. With this, we are touching upon the great fundamental question of the present time, a question that people should be concerning themselves with in preference to all the secondary questions that preoccupy them today. If people were to concern themselves with this basic question, they would find ways and means of bringing fruitful ideas to bear upon present-day realities. And this would be a way of getting away from abstract concepts. It is not so easy to distinguish reality from illusion. In these circumstances, one really needs to want to enter into life with all seriousness and goodwill, instead of being content with programs and prejudices. I could give you lots of examples of this kind of phenomenon, but I shall cite just one instance. At the beginning of the 1890s, a number of people came together in several different towns or cities in Europe and imitated something in the American style, namely the, quote, movement for ethical culture, close quote. The impulse for founding these, quote, societies for ethical culture, close quote, emanated at that time from certain intellectuals. These people produced some very beautiful things. And if you read today the articles that were written then by these representatives of the societies for ethical culture, if you have a taste for such rich and refined fare, you will probably still be able to take delight in all the beautiful ideals in which these people were indulging at that time. And it was indeed no pleasant task to take issue with this wallowing in such rich and refined ideals. However, I wrote an article in one of the first numbers of the journal Der Zukunft, the future, that was critical of this oily indulgence of ethical culture, in quotes, and indeed had a massive grumble about it. It was, of course, a shameful thing to do, for it was indeed somewhat shameful to cast negative aspersions upon something so worthy, when these people were, after all, aiming to make the whole world ethical and moral. I was living at the time in Weimar, but when paying a visit to Berlin, I spoke with Hermann Grimm, who said, quote, "What is your problem with this ethical culture? Approach the people themselves, and you will see that those who are coming together here in Berlin to speak about ethics are really nice, kind people. One really cannot have any problem with them. They are people who can be really nice to know, who one can come to like very well." Close quote. None of this could be denied, and at the time Hermann Grimm was no less right than I was. Outwardly, one of us was just as right at that particular moment as the other. The case of each of us could be proved just as well as the other's. And I would not want to maintain that from a purely logical point of view, my issues with these ethical philosophers were more justified than those brought forward by them. But it is from this over-refined idealism that the present catastrophe has arisen. And the only people who were right and have been justified by events are those who said at that time, "With all your indulgent talk about high-faluting ideals, through which you want to bring universal peace, universal morality, and other such aims to humanity, you have given rise to nothing other than what I have called the social carcinoma, that in the end led inevitably to the present catastrophe." Time has shown who has been working with real concepts and who has been working with mere abstractions. When concepts are purely abstract in character, it is impossible to decide whether someone is right or wrong. The only decisive factor is whether or not an idea finds its rightful place in the course of events. When a professor is teaching science at a university, he can, of course, give beautiful and logical proofs that everything that he is saying is correct. All this goes right into the holes of the head, and on this occasion I mean this in the best sense, close parenthesis. But you see, the question is not whether any apparently good logical grounds can be given, but that the same thoughts, when they enter a head such as Lenin's, become Bolshevism. What matters is what a thought becomes in reality. It is of no importance what one can think about it or what one can feel about it in an abstract sense, but what power is forming a thought in its actual reality. And if one is evaluating that worldview that most people have been speaking about recently, because the others have been preoccupied with aesthetics, namely socialism, it is not now a question of getting down to swatting up on Karl Marx or LaSalle or Bernstein, in other words, studying their books, studying these writers, but of having a feeling, a living experience for what will happen in the further progress of mankind if a number of people, the sort of people who stand at machines, have these thoughts. This is what matters. Rather than having ideas about the social structure in the near future that are taught in the accepted course of diplomatic training. Now is the time when what matters is to be able to weigh up thoughts so as to be able to answer the question, what is wanted by the times in the coming decades? The time has now already come when it is not enough to sit in comfort on a variety of magisterial chairs and quietly continue cherishing old habits. It is now time when people must experience the shock of confronting themselves, when the thought needs to arise in those who are responsible anywhere for anything. How is this question to be solved out of the inner life? We shall speak further about this next time. The end of Lecture 6.